Jacob is the bearer of really great promises, and I just want to highlight a few of them. God told him earlier in this chapter, in a dream, in verse 13, "The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your offspring." I said in this earlier in this chapter, I mean in chapter 28 that we concluded last week. Chapter 28, 13, "The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your offspring." In chapter 28, 14, that very next verse, he said, "Your offspring will be like the dust of the earth, and you'll spread abroad to the west and the east and the north and the south. And in you and in your offspring shall all families of the earth be blessed." And in verse 15, he promised, "I'm with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I've done what I've promised you." These are incredible promises. And Jacob will need these promises about God's power, about God's presence, because of what's coming next. Jacob is heading into a situation that he cannot foresee. And the details of this might be different for our lives, of course, but the undergirding principle is God has made promises for his people and a confidence and a trust that we should have in him, because we head again and again into days and weeks that we cannot foresee. And Jacob is heading into a situation that he is confident God will resolve in terms of getting a wife and offspring from that. But he cannot imagine all that is lying before him. He needs children and first of all a wife. But the complicated circumstances ahead of him in Haran with his uncle Laban, he could not possibly have anticipated. Life takes interesting turns. And God's made great promises and God's going to use Jacob. But things are going to get very complicated for him in short order. So we should say a word about this scene that begins in chapter 29 that I read from tonight. When I read this statement about this shepherd at the well, set of shepherds, this woman who comes to it, and the fact that she will end up being someone Jacob will marry, there could be a bit of deja vu for the reader, and that would be appropriate. Haven't we seen something like this before? And the answer is yes, we have. In Genesis, they like to use type scenes or molds or pattern kind of scenes that they take, and there are similar elements in some sort of skeletal form, and the flesh and the skin look different in different stories. But underneath, there is something that's like what we've seen already. And the like scene is Genesis 24. Because Abraham had sent his servant to go find Isaac a wife. And Rebekah comes out to a well. And lo and behold, you know who else appears in Genesis 24? Laban, her brother. We'd seen him previously. Now, he gets a much larger role, it seems, in the verses to come. But in Genesis 24, he made already an appearance. In an earlier story than in Genesis 24, there was some sort of going to a land of relatives. There was an arrival at a well. There was a girl who is a relative of the groom. And she's coming to draw water at the well. And so this person who then comes to the well draws water for her. That's what Eliezer does in Genesis 24. That's what Jacob does here. This girl then goes back to the home and reports the meeting. That person who came to the well is then brought into this girl's house. An exchange and conversations take place. And then ultimately a marriage takes place with this girl at the well. And so in Genesis 29, when we read this and we think, I feel like I've read something like this before. The book of Genesis works that way on all kinds of different fronts. And I've tried to point out again and again parallels and similarities to previous stories. And we by no means exhausted them. There will be more to come. In fact, some Old Testament scholars think that this particular narrative gives the kind of cast or mold that Moses is later, that a narrative is later built on about Moses in Exodus 2. Just to read you a few verses from Exodus 2 to remind you what I mean. In Exodus 2:15, we're told that when Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by it just happens to be a well. And now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. But shepherds who were there came and drove them away. Moses, though, stood up and saved them and watered their flock. And when they came home to their father, he said, "How is it that you've come so soon?" They said, an Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock. And he said, where is he? Where have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. Moses was content to dwell. And then the father gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. So the idea of a well being a really major location for what turns out to be the meeting of future spouses is key. Now, Eliezer went to the well in Genesis 24 and not Isaac, but Eliezer was the representative. And so it's a way of saying, yes, even Isaac, through the representative Eliezer, his wife was discovered at a well. In our story tonight, I think five parts we can discern. We're in verses 1 to 8, Jacob's meeting shepherds. In verses 9 to 12, meeting Rachel in particular. And then Laban in verses 13 to 14. The story takes a shift in verses 15 to 20 when they make an agreement together that it turns out in verses 21 to 30 results in a deception by Laban. Laban does not keep the agreement that was understood by Jacob. And Jacob is deceived. I've entitled this evening's message, Deceiving the Deceiver, because there is an irony here. Jacob has set various plots of deception, or at least manipulation, in some way seizing what he wants with the birthright in Genesis 25 with Esau, and later the blessing in Genesis 27. And so he has some wily ways about him that have already been seen. What goes around comes around in a weird way with this story. Because what he has sown is deception, and what he is reaping is himself being deceived by his uncle Laban. There are greater similarities that I think are really intended by the text here that we'll work out as we go through. So in verses 1 to 8, he meets some shepherds. We're told in verse 1 that he is on his journey coming to the people of the east. This land is the land of Padan Aram that he's been heading toward. And the specific area that he needs to be in is Haran, because this city is where his family, his extended family, is. And Abraham's brother Nahor had encamped there from Genesis 11 onward. And therefore, as Nahor had had children, they are now going to essentially provide the spouse, these one generation after another, there's going to be a spouse named Rachel that Jacob is interested in. And so Jacob arrives there, and we're told in verse 2 that he sees a well in the field, but it's not an empty area. There are flocks that have already gathered. So I want you to think for a moment about the scene. There's a well, and it's currently covered, and there are flocks that are sitting nearby with their sheep, not watering them. Okay, they're not watering them. They've got the well covered. Now, Jacob is going to think this is strange. He's going to point this out in a moment. But the shepherds are there, and they've got their flocks, and we're going to learn in what Jacob says that it's the middle of the day, basically. It's not as if they've come to the end of the pasturing for the day and they're going to all sort of rest together or something. Not like that at all. So he sees the well and he sees flocks beside it, and there's a stone on the mouth of the well. This is a practical addition to the well, because if you have a stone that you can put on it and take off, first of all, that's going to be difficult for things to just fall into the well and dirty up the water. Okay, this is a way of certainly keeping it clean. It's also a good way to keep some individual traveler from going along, and when he comes across this massive rock, he realizes that he's going to be unable to do this. According to these shepherds, it takes multiple people who are going to move this particular rock, and so it's an incentive for certain things and a deterrent in others. In verse 3, tells us that when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep. We're having the custom reported to us. This is what would typically happen. And then they would put the stone back in its place after the sheep were watered. It would go right over the mouth of the well. So Jacob sees this situation, but he may not know of the custom. So he says, in greeting them, "My brothers, where do you come from?" And the first element of good news is really good news right up front. They tell him that we are from Haran, and this is what Jacob needs to know, because this is where his family is that he's heading toward. And he says to them, "Well, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And this second question is met with more good news. They indeed not only are from the right place, they know the right person. They do know Laban of Nahor. And then he tells them Well, is it well with him? And I think that's just a way of saying, is he doing okay? Is he alive? How's his health? I mean, it's a way of inquiring about Laban personally. And they affirm positively that he's well. And then they point to his daughter, who they see, I guess, coming with her sheep. And they say, see, or behold, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with sheep. Now, Jacob now zeroes in on the situation that there's this well. The shepherds are there with their flock, but nobody's watering any animals. So here's what he points out. Behold, it's still high day. It's not time for the livestock to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them. It's almost as if Jacob adopts a rebuke disposition. He sort of calls them out. Why are you guys just sitting around? We're in the middle of the day. Why are we all gathering around? Water your flocks and be on. And amen. And so somebody, a Bible reader might read this and think, well, Jacob's awfully brash. He's never met these shepherds before, and he's basically just coming along and giving them orders, maybe even implying that they're somewhat lazy. What are you guys doing here? And so some people have wondered if the character of Jacob is not being, you know, very much on display. He's just being very bold and just kind of saying what he thinks. And here he is telling them what to do. And then they say to him, though, in verse 8, we cannot. Okay, now listen to this. We cannot until all the flocks are gathered together. So apparently, everybody who would be gathering at the well has not yet arrived. I wonder how many people they're waiting on. But they're waiting on more people to come. And then he says, then the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep. All of that is plural. We gather together. We roll the stone and all the rest. They're together in this. It seems that this stone requires more than just a couple people who are going to move it. The reason that's important is because of what will happen later in the story. So that's verses 1 to 8. And in verse 9, while he's still speaking to them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And as soon as Jacob sees her in verse 10, and by the way, we're told a couple times the family relation, Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob sees the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. The narrator is reminding us, hey, what Jacob has been hoping for and looking for, that's coming to pass. You're watching promises being kept by the Lord. You're watching the providence of God at work. That's what's happening here. So Jacob came near, and look at what he does. He comes near, and he rolls the stone from the well's mouth, and he watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. What a sight that must have been. And Old Testament scholars are in widespread agreement here that what we are watching is Jacob manifest an incredible feat of strength. He's acting very Samson-esque in the moment, if you will, where he has this incredible strength in this episode to move this stone. And I think that further demonstrates the divine coming together of these events. Jacob is even able to do what perhaps just a couple, two or three of these shepherds would not have just labor to do by themselves. So he comes, rolls the stone away, waters the flock. I mean, he is just seizing the moment, isn't he? He's taking initiative, and he sees her. This must have been very impressive to Rachel, right? Because Jacob is performing a physical act that she would have come day after day and watched multiple people do. And so she sees him do this, right? It doesn't tell us he flexed or anything afterward, but it must have been really impressive, I assure you, for him to just be, to do that, and then she watches it. And then in verse 11, as if things weren't taking an interesting enough turn, Jacob then kissed Rachel and wept aloud. Now let that verse sit on you for a moment, okay? It's like, what is your first name? Because up to this point, we don't know that Jacob has told her anything. We just know that in the very next verse, he identifies himself and how they're related. So at this point, he comes up to her, kisses her, and weeps aloud. Now, we should say a few things. We should note that it was customary among relatives to greet one another with a kiss. So she could have assumed, not that something creepy was happening necessarily, but that this person may have been a friend of the family or a family member himself. But the weeping aloud combined with this greeting, this affectionate greeting, it indicates the weight of the moment. Jacob, it just seems to be just reacting. He's just, He's so excited about what's happening. He kisses Rachel. He's weeping. This must be a sight for her to see, all right? She's watched him do this incredible feat of strength, and now he's just crying like a baby. And she doesn't know any more of these details yet, but it went from one extreme to the other just like that. And so Jacob here is excited and thrilled by the success of his journey. After all, here's a family member that is Laban's daughter, and here he's in the right place with the right person. So he must be overwhelmed. God had promised, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to keep my promises. And it's as if Jacob is watching this unfold. It's just come together. And in verse 12, Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman, that he was Rebekah's son. That's how specific it gets. And then she ran and told her father. So she's going to go and inform Laban. And this news reaches him. So this takes us to verses 13 and 14. Jacob meets Laban. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, because again, Laban and Rebekah are brother and sister, Laban ran out to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him to his house, and Jacob told Laban all these things. That's a very warm greeting. Laban gets a good impression here, all right? It won't last long, but he makes a good impression here. He's very welcoming, very hospitable. Brings Jacob into the home. Now, what does Jacob tell Laban? We're told that he told Laban all these things, and in verse 14, Laban said, well, surely you are my bone and my flesh. So at the very least, Laban is hearing not only from Rachel's mouth that Jacob is in some way connected to the family, Jacob is explaining it. Jacob is explaining it. Now, he may have told other things. He may have spoken about what happened at the well. He may have spoken about his journey. He may have spoken about other promises. We don't know what else it would have included. But Laban, from this conversation, concludes the following in verse 14. He says, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And Jacob stayed with him a month. That is a month before the following things happen. So several weeks are going to go by before the next thing. Now, we read these first 14 verses together and we've looked at them. And right now, things seem to be going all too well, right? Things are going smoothly. Things are going easily. And if you know a way of looking at life and making those observations, it can seem like the calm before the storm, where you think things seem to be going just a little too well right now. And I wonder if something could be down the road. And here, in verses 15 to 20, Jacob makes an agreement with Laban, and this proves to be the calm before the storm for Jacob's life. It tells us in verse 15, Laban says to Jacob, because you're my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be? We have to consider the context here. Jacob does not come with a bunch of possessions and provisions. He has actually left everything with Isaac and the family. Jacob doesn't have all of the stuff that Abraham and the other people around Abraham's household and beyond would have had all those years ago. Jacob, there's no indication here he brings any of that. And yet, it was important for the caller, if you will, the gentleman caller, to bring some sort of bride price for the wife. This creates a difficulty because normally a family member isn't required to engage in some sort of economic wage transaction with another family member. They would help for free. But this is a different kind of situation because Jacob is interested in one of Laban's daughters. And so he says, because you're my kinsman, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be? And Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. And so Jacob is going to speak about Rachel in just a moment. I think that this is a way of them establishing a bride price, okay? Jacob is going to then be able, instead of just giving funds to Laban, what he's going to be doing is offering Laban his service. This is going to be in view of attaining one of Laban's daughters, okay? This creates a longer situation. It's not as if Jacob could have just shown up with the money or whatever bride price and then take the wife. This is going to take longer because Jacob doesn't have what would be necessary. The importance of a bride price is that if something would have happened to Jacob, if he were to die or if he were to divorce Rachel, the family would have enough funds to be able to support her in her age, especially if she were older, especially if she had children. It would be important for the family to have that kind of financial cushion. So the bride price wasn't really something negotiable in the ancient world. It was expected. And Jacob knows this. And you get a sense in this chapter, he's very willing and eager to do what it takes. Okay, he doesn't want to circumvent this. So in verse 16, we're told that, look, there are two daughters. The name of the older is Leah, and the name of the younger is Rachel. I just want to point out for a moment that Jacob is part of a family where earlier in Genesis 25, we were told Esau is the older and Jacob is the younger. And here we're told Leah is the older and Rachel is the younger. Now, in Genesis 25 and in Genesis 27, the younger, in this case, Jacob, deceived and ended up, in deceiving Isaac, stealing something from Esau, the younger against the older. Here, Leah is going to work with her father on the night when he's supposed to be marrying Rachel, and Jacob is going to be taking Leah into the bridal chamber, who is the older, with her father deceiving Jacob in a bit of an ironic twist. In verse 17, it tells us that Leah's eyes are weak and Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. And some readers have looked at this verse and have concluded, well, Rachel must have been physically attractive and Leah had been unattractive physically. But I don't think that is a fair reading of the verse. In fact, the idea that Leah's eyes are weak can simply mean, and needs mean nothing more than Leah's appearance was not as blastingly dazzling as was Rachel's. But it need not mean anything negative. It just perhaps means that if somebody were to look at Rachel and to look at Leah, they would say that Rachel was more beautiful. And here, I don't think we should say Laban's trying to figure out how he's going to get his unattractive daughter married off. You know, you hear people talk about this story, and I've heard preachers say, well, Laban didn't know what to do because he looked at Leah and he thought, I mean, well, then we need to somehow trick somebody. I don't think that's the fairest way of looking at it. I think that reads too much into the text. The idea that Leah's eyes are weak is the extent of what it says about her appearance. And that's not necessarily something negative. It's just in comparison to Rachel, it seems that Rachel was much more dazzlingly physically attractive. Okay, well, moving on from there. In verse 18, we're told Jacob loved Rachel. So he's made his heart's choice, right? He said, I will serve you, talking to Laban, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. He's specific. The younger, not the older. And he went ahead and said her name. There's no misunderstanding here. It's not like he said, I want to serve you for your daughter. And then Laban, you know, gives him one. And Jacob said, oh, I was hoping for the other. Jacob says, it's your younger one. It's her name is Rachel. And Laban, you know this, okay? Jacob has his heart set. And in verse 19, Laban says, it's better that I give her to you than I should give her to any other man. Laban hasn't switched names here. All Jacob knows and all the reader knows is that we're still talking about the same person. Now, I don't know in Laban's mind, he's already started thinking about what he's going to do, but some years are going to go by before it comes to fruition. He said, it's better I give her to you than I should give her to any other man. Stay with me. So this means he's going to serve Laban for 7 years. And Jacob does in verse 20. He serves 7 years for Rachel. And then it tells us, and they seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her. Well, isn't that sweet? Right? He is so enamored with Rachel. 7 years just flew by. He blinked and then 7 years had passed. Now we're told in verses 21 to 30 a series of events that I've lumped under Jacob's deception by Laban. So Jacob is the receiver, in this case, of some sort of plot, some sort of conjuring in his deceptive method that ends up in some kind of loss for Jacob in his judgment. In verses 21 to the end of our passage tonight, we learn that Jacob says to Laban at this point, after the 7 years are over, give me my wife that I may go into her for my time is completed. And yes, he means what it sounds like he means. He wants to marry her and to consummate the marriage. And his language here isn't meant, I think, to be crass to his father-in-law. I think what he's trying to say, essentially, is he wants to build this family with her, and he knows that he's been promised offspring by the Lord, so he intends to carry this out. This is part of his plan. And so he is very clear that this is his purpose. And when he says, my time is completed, he means those 7 years. Laban, our agreement, our contract, stipulated 7 years, and now, well, let's take care of things. It's interesting, though, that he says, give me my wife. I mean, you could observe that, well, wait a second, you know, they haven't actually, why is he saying that Rachel is his wife? Well, you could, in the ancient world, consider the betrothed status to put one in the kind of formal relationship that you could refer in wifely terms to your fiancé, so to speak. Even though engagement in fiancé language is a little less than what it meant in the ancient world. It was binding so much that if you broke an engagement, it was considered a legal divorce. And I would simply point you to the story of the Virgin Mary and Joseph in Matthew chapter 1 to demonstrate someone who planned to do that because until the angel confronted him, he just believed that Mary had been unfaithful, which by the way was a reasonable conclusion. All right. So in verse 21, he says, give me my wife that I may go into her, for my time is completed. And so Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. This is going to be one kind of wedding feast that results probably in Jacob being a little weakened, at least a little weakened, in his senses. Because the language about making a feast includes some sort of drinking gathering where the festivities could result in someone not thinking or seeing as clearly as they ought. And this certainly serves Laban's purposes, and it does not help Jacob's at all. And so he says, it tells us here, Laban gathered all the people of the place, and he made a feast. The idea of a feast and a celebration for a wedding went on for several days. So you had the initial day where you had this grand ceremony and the bride and the husband and the wife then went into the bridal chamber and they consummated the marriage. And then for days on end, there was celebration. So this was a feast that would last probably for a week. Okay, this is a big deal. And in verse 23, in the evening, all right, this is Laban, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and he, Jacob, went into her. We should note here that something has been switched consciously by Laban, and this also requires the complicit deeds of Leah as well. She's in on this, right? So Laban and Leah have at some point agreed that this is what we're going to do on the wedding night. It was very customary in the ancient world for people to wear veils, even in the bridal chamber. It was very customary to have the particular consummation of the marriage at night after the festivities of the day have ended. So if you think circumstantially for a moment, in a room with little or no light, with a veiled woman, in a particular circumstance that would have taken place in the evening anyway, with festivities and no doubt wine that have clouded the judgment, it's very plausible that what we're about to read is what happened. So in the evening, he takes his daughter Leah, brings her to Jacob, and he went into her. And the only way, one of the important connections we should see in this story is the deception that has been perpetrated upon Jacob. Here's what a few Old Testament scholars have noticed. Jacob pretended to be Esau in front of Isaac, and Leah pretends to be Rachel right next to Jacob. While Jacob's ruse was pretending to be his older brother, Leah's ruse is pretending to be her younger sister. And obviously, Leah is in on it with Laban from the beginning when you get to this bridal chamber. We don't know when the switch takes place, but it seems that in some way, Rachel may not have been involved in this festivity at all if Leah had been veiled. We don't know what Jacob knew or what role Rachel had, if any at all, in that day. It may have been Leah the whole time for all Laban's efforts. At least by the end of things, that's exactly what happened. And when he realized who he's married to, he says it was Leah. So we're also told in verse 24 that Laban gave his female servant Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her servant. It was very customary for a bride's father to give a wedding gift, to present some sort of dowry to the daughter. Well, in this case, he gives her a servant named Zilpah. And more on that in just a moment. Now, fast forward to verse 25 in the morning. All right? So the night has passed. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. Can you imagine in Jacob's mind what he must be thinking? He's so upset and he says to Laban, "What is this you have done to me?" He knows exactly who's behind it. "What is this you have done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me?" Now the language of deceiving someone is exactly what Isaac and Esau say about Jacob in Genesis 27. When Isaac says, "Your brother has deceived me." And now Jacob is using that word because now it's been done to him. Not only that, the complaint, "What is this you have done?" fits with multiple previous episodes. In Genesis 12, when Abraham deceives Pharaoh, and when he deceives Abimelech in Genesis 20, both Pharaoh and Abimelech say, "What is this you have done to us?" or in some fashion like that. We're also seeing it similarly when God speaks to the serpent in Genesis 3 and to Cain in Genesis 4. "What is this you have done?" That kind of language of rebuke. Something has happened that ought not to have happened. The deceiver, Jacob, has been deceived. And in verse 26, we learn something about the custom of the country. Now remember, at the beginning of the chapter, there was a custom about how shepherds behaved. You know, all the shepherds would wait for a certain group of them to gather, and then they would all roll the stone, and then or take a stone off, and then they would all water their flocks, and then they would all put it back on. Well, here's something else that Jacob needed to know. Laban said, "What's not so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn?" Well, that would have been good information 7 years ago, right? That would have been really helpful to know years ago. Ironically, Jacob is forced to learn about the right of the firstborn that ought to have been respected. And scholars have pointed out how, well, Jacob, knowing how the firstborn ought to have been treated, certainly didn't care regarding Esau. And now, here, he has unintentionally and ignorantly, though in fact done it, violated, it seems, the custom, expecting that the younger would be his before the older. And Laban says, "Well, it's just not done so in our country." And Laban's response here seems to assume the moral high ground as if he has any. I don't think there's any good person with moral high ground in this particular episode. I mean, Laban certainly has deceived Jacob. Jacob and Laban talked about Rachel. Laban knows that. Jacob knows that. Laban is simply deceiving Jacob. And then, in a way, feigning moral outrage. "Well, that's just not how it's done in our country. You don't give the older, you don't give the younger before the firstborn." Expecting that Jacob would have followed that. When verses 27 to the end, a surprising turn of events, it turns out Jacob will be able to get Rachel after all. But listen to this. Oh, in verse 27, "Complete the week of this one," which probably means the bridal week of festivities with Leah, "and we will give you the other also in return for serving me another 7 years." So the week of this one refers to that week of festivities with Leah. But, you know, I mean, Laban here is trying to get all he can out of it, you know. He's read the art of the deal and he is putting it all into practice. He here sees the opportunity and like, "I can get Rachel as well. And I can get 7 more years of service." So here is what he is putting forward as a negotiation. And it might not seem, from our perspective, we think, "Jacob, another 7 years. Okay, you have a wife. God's promised you offspring." But Jacob's heart was set on Rachel. And we're told earlier, Jacob loved Rachel in Genesis 29:18. We're never told that about Leah. In fact, in the verses to come in this chapter, Leah feels like a hated wife. Jacob loves Rachel. And Rachel may know this. And Jacob is going to do this. But sometimes Bible readers read this story and they think that it happened in this particular order. He worked 7 years and got Leah, and then worked 7 years and got Rachel. But it didn't happen in that order. What happened was he worked 7 years and gets Leah, and then we're told in verse 28, Jacob did so, completed her week, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Jacob doesn't wait another 7 years to get Rachel. He gets Rachel then. In fact, if you're Jacob, that would be something you would want to insist on at that point, because the last time you worked 7 years thinking you were going to get one person, it turned out not to be that. You would insist on, oh no, this time around, let's get the wife first, and then I will agree to 7 years. But Jacob does fulfill his obligation, despite being deceived and swindled by his uncle Laban. So in verse 29, Laban gave his female servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel to be her servant. This is the second servant that Jacob has received in the story, and then the second wife. So Jacob now has two wives and two servants. These two servants will later be given as wives in Genesis 29 and 30 to have children. And we're going to see this later next week. But these four ladies, Leah, Rachel, Zilpah, and Bilhah, will be the mothers of the 12 sons of Israel. That's how significant these ladies are. So this looks like, I mean, it's a difficult set of circumstances. It's awkward. It's kind of gut-wrenching, especially when you think of, I mean, folks, not 7 days, not 7 months, 7 years. That's a long time. And then four deceptions to then take place. And then the agreement to be seven more. Jacob doesn't say, well, no, thank you. I'll take Leah and be done. He works seven more for Rachel. He loved Rachel, it says. Now, in verse 30, Jacob went into Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. There is something about this family regarding favoritism that has been present in Jacob's life. I mean, it tells us in Genesis 25 that Isaac loved Esau and Rebekah loved Jacob. And now this isn't parental favoritism, this is marital favoritism. Jacob's heart is for Rachel and not for Leah. But he did serve Laban another 7 years. You still wonder, though, what kind of friction this is going to produce. This is not an ideal set of circumstances at all. Jacob is going to be in a very interesting procreating set of verses to come as these 12 children are born. And I think there are important connections in the story, though, that we can zoom out and affirm. Let's remember that Jacob, like Isaac, has married a woman that was discovered at a well. Okay, there's a type scene or a pattern, a mold that's then repeated. And again, I pointed how in Exodus chapter 2, this happens with Moses. When he comes to the aid of those women, and then the women, their father, gives one of the daughters Zipporah to Moses. So Jacob is like a new Isaac. And Isaac has been portrayed in Genesis as a new Abraham. I think it's important to note that from one story to the next, the characteristics about the events in these people's lives are being shown one after another from one generation to the next. It helps us affirm that God is indeed at work in them, because the same kinds of circumstances and promises are given, and you see the Lord prevailing despite the foolishness of the people. Sometimes these patriarchs are making the same mistakes. Remember how Abraham lied about his wife and said that she wasn't his wife, only his sister? Well, Isaac did that very thing in Genesis 26. So not only are the similarities in good areas, sometimes the same foibles and weaknesses are present in the patriarchs. And it shows the prevailing purposes of God despite the same faults in these characters. We're also reminded that in this story, Jacob, like Isaac, is deceived by failing to see who is truly with him. Isaac did not see who was truly with him in Genesis 27. He thought he was speaking to Esau. And Jacob had deceived him. And Jacob, on this wedding night, thinks that he's with Rachel. But he fails to see and know that indeed it is Leah. We're also reminded As I mentioned already, that Jacob, and though it was in ignorance, he didn't abide by the practice that honored the marrying of the firstborn before the giving of the younger. And yet Jacob, early on, did not seem to give much thought to the importance of the firstborn, but rather simply wanted the birthright and wanted the blessing. And however he needed to get it, he and his mother did. Leah may not have been Jacob's plan A, but let's think about what happens after this, friends. Leah is going to give birth to Levi and to Judah. So in Jacob's mind, if he could have had it his way, it would have turned out differently. But God is going to use this unloved daughter and wife, Leah, to bring about what will ultimately be the priestly line in the Levites and the tribe of Judah from Judah's line. And Judah is the royal tribe, the tribe from which the kings in Jerusalem will come, the tribe from which Jesus will come. So when Jacob is in these hardships, he doesn't know what's happening centuries from now. He doesn't understand how these things are going to work out in the plan of God. And how many of us really do when we think about the details of our lives. Especially when life takes unexpected turns. When we can't foresee what the week will hold or the month or even a period of 7 years. We don't know how things are going to wind up. We don't know in the big picture what the Lord may be doing. But Leah will give birth to the son from whose tribe will come the Savior of the world. And though Jacob's heart was not initially for her, God will do a great thing. God is with Jacob, even in these hard circumstances. Jacob would probably have preferred, surely, as we might expect, that these hard circumstances not have existed at all. And yet, the Lord said in Genesis 28, I will be with you. I'm going to keep my promises. I'm going to be with you to the end until I've done everything that I've promised. That didn't cease to be the case when he shows up in Haran. God is continuing to be with Jacob. God's continuing to keep promises in the midst of hard and unexpected circumstances. In the midst of Jacob's foolishness. In the midst of Laban's deception. None of that is going to override the overarching plan of God, a plan that will take us all the way to our Savior, who will be born from one of Leah's sons. It's a wonderful thing. And this story, like the other stories in Genesis we've seen, again and again points us to the trustworthiness of God and to the character of God and to, in many cases, the suspect heroes in these stories, where we wonder, you know, what sort of characteristics they have that should be emulated when they do have so many flaws and make so many foolish errors and sins. And yet, the stories in Genesis are not about trying to view Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as heroes. I think amidst all of these stories, just like the Jesus Storybook Bible tells us that Sally Lloyd-Jones put together for children, and which I think all adults should read and enjoy too, that God is the hero of these stories. Above and beyond all of these things these characters are doing, from each other, to each other, with each other, there is a plan unfolding. And even though Jacob could not see that it was Leah he was with, the reader and the initial hearers of these stories could not see thousands of years later what the Lord would unfold. It causes us to trust the Lord. It reminds us of his providence that even through hard circumstances is at work and displays his faithfulness and requires faithfulness from us. Let's pray together.